are screaming now. They brought Deadtown Hometown Boys, Deadtown Hometown Boys, Deadtown.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today's show, let's talk about a few reports and the two items of interest economically in the past week. That, of course, is the jobs report today and the passage yesterday of Trump Care, the House version anyway, and what it represents. And then I want to talk about my latest print publication called Is Trump Really President? I mean, is he really running the show? Is he the President of the United States? Or is something else weirdly going on? Well, we're going to address that topic. If you want to read my version of that, raising that question, you can go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, or you can go to Counterpunch, where it initially appeared. That's the blog Counterpunch. They may have put it up on a PRN website. I don't know. I sent it to them. We'll see whether. But it's time to start asking us, what is the nature of this presidency? Is this guy really running the show? I'm beginning to have doubts. I'm beginning to think that, they sort of trot him out and, he does his tweet thing at night, sitting up there on the second floor late at night, and in the mornings they trot him out to sign these executive orders, and then he goes back upstairs. There's no one in the White House except him. His family's not there, nothing. This is weird. And, he has interviews once in a while with reporters, and if he doesn't like what they say, he pouts and he, stomps out. Or he puts on these four-hour tours for his friends. His friends come to the White House and he gives them a four-hour tour. What's this? He's the President of the United States. What's he doing? Spending 4 hours giving personal tours? It's weird, folks. It's really weird. We got a strange thing going on over here, and I think it'll become more and more clear that it's stranger and stranger. Anyway, before we get to that, is Trump really president? I want to talk about a few other developments. One on the U.S. economy here. We hear all this talk about, we got a big recovery going, big boom, and so forth. And there's an increase in some business spending, which was coming off the floor, virtually zero in recent years. And now, business is thinking, well, maybe we're going to get infrastructure spending, maybe we're going to get tax cuts, and maybe we're going to get deregulation, and we're going to end up with more money in our pockets. And, looks like the job market's at full employment, which, of course, it's not. And people are going to spend more. So, let's invest and step up production a little bit, and that's why you get a little bit increase in business spending here in first quarter. But, remember the GDP first quarter was only 0.7%. Other than that little blip in business spending, there wasn't much of anything going on in the first quarter. U.S. GDP is overinflated anyway. They count a lot of phony stuff like R&D and intellectual property, which is a way of them overinflating business spending. My estimates in the past have been about $250 billion minimum of GDP every year is this smoke and mirrors price estimation of items that used to be cost, but now they count them as investment in GDP. So, if there's an increase in business spending, you got to reduce it by about a third, and that's probably what it's more accurately. So, and it remains to be seen if this business spending can continue into the rest of the year. If you don't get an increase in business activity and consumption activity and government activity, then, business spending plans can fade just as quickly. And we'll see how that turns out for the rest of the year. But I'm a little skeptical that we're actually going to see a sustained business spending going on, and I'll explain why. And certainly not on the consumption side with households, and we'll explain why. But it looks like questionable to me whether there's going to be a continued recovery here and just a little blip, the Trump trade, you know, they call that the Trump trade that pushed up stocks. Well, you know, stocks are always looking forward, and they're not so sure either in the stock market after a healthy 10-15% boost here since the election in anticipation of growth, and now that anticipation expectation is fading. And we see the stock markets sort of stagnating at the level they had attained, and they're churning. We'll see what happens here with whether Trump can come through with some real economic activity. And, you know, they are victims of their own economic ideology. They believe that simply putting more money in the hands of business is going to result in more investment and therefore more jobs, more employment, more jobs, more income for business and households, and therefore more spending and a higher growth rate. This is the old neoclassical myth that if you increase the supply of money in the hands of business, they will automatically invest it. And they'll do it immediately. They won't hoard it. Put more money in the hands of business, and they'll invest it, and that's how you get recovery. Well, that's a myth, because you put more money, you lower the cost of investment, in other words, in the hands of business. It doesn't necessarily get directed into investment, or that investment gets redirected offshore by businesses, or they hoard the cash on their balance sheets, or they invest it in financial asset markets instead, or, you know, they distribute it in dividend payouts and stock buybacks to their shareholders. You know, none of that translates into actual real investment. And that's been a problem, you see, for at least a couple decades now, at least since 2000. We've had this problem of a lack of real investment going on. Oh, not surprising, the report comes out yesterday or the day before, and it says that, U.S. productivity is only growing at 0.6% rate now. 0.6%. Actually, it's been growing at that rate for some time here on and off, but now it's, once again, it's almost collapsed. There's no productivity going on. Well, that's because there's no real investment going on, except, of course, this little blip in business spending here in the last couple months that may not be sustained. You know, that 6% growth rate, right, compares to in 2015, a 1.1% growth rate. And that's down from a decade earlier where we had a 1.5% growth rate. And that's down from the historical average of previous decades of 2.6% productivity rate. So we are growing at what, 20%? Productivity is only growing at one-fifth of what it usually, on average, historically has grown. Productivity is collapsing. And by the way, it's not a problem just in the U.S. It's a problem everywhere. Even the IMF said, whoa, there's a problem in Europe with productivity, and the Japanese the same. Everywhere. The capitalist system is not investing in real plant and equipment. Well, where's all the money going? Well, it's being hoarded, and it's going into financial investing. And there was another report that said, an article in the Financial Times that indicated most of the big companies that make things in the United States now are owned by private equity firms. These are financial manipulators. Yeah, so behind the scenes, you got Carlyle, KKK, and these other big players that own these companies. And they're not interested in long-term income streams from introducing new product lines in these companies. No, they're interested in short-term profits. Yeah, these are the guys behind the scene running the show. It's big finance is gobbling up, you know, the traditional capitalist economy, and the consequences of which we were beginning to feel, and that is they're not interested in expanding investment and producing more things. They're interested in how to manipulate price and make profits that way. Okay, so the result that we see, you know, I talked about the productivity figures collapsing, but behind the productivity figures, you see non-residential fixed capital investment. And there was not housing and not commercial property, which has been relatively stagnant, but investing in plant and equipment, right, to produce things and so forth. A decade ago, and before, it was running on average at 12% per year. Now it's only 3.3%. So fixed capital investment is collapsing along with productivity. You know, what's the chicken, what's the egg here? Well, they're both reinforcing each other, right? If you're not investing in fixed capital, you know, your productivity is going to be low. And if productivity is going to be low, you know, you can't raise prices. And if you can't raise prices, you're not going to invest. So it's, you know, a downward cycle, a vicious downward cycle here between fixed capital and productivity collapsing. Well, you know, that's important long-run economic information here that we need to keep in mind. All right, so another report come out today, and that is jobs, the jobs numbers. Okay, jobs numbers last month, only 79,000 jobs were created last month. All right, this month they say it's 211,000. So that's 300,000 in 2 months, which averages out to about 150,000 a month, which is just about what it takes to give work to new entrants into the labor force. In other words, you will just sort of stay even, break even in terms of job creation as more people look for jobs. Right, and you create 150,000 a month. That April number that just came out of 211,000 will probably be estimated downward, just as last month was. Last month initially was 98,000. Now they reduced it to 79. So, you know, I think that the 200,000 is probably going to be, 211,000 is probably going to be maybe 190,000, 200,000. And that means our average is probably around 130,000 for the last 2 months, and that compares with all of last year of 180,000 a month. Okay, so 140,000 the last few months compared to 180,000 in 2016, compared in 2015 to 226,000, compared in 2014 to 250,000. In other words, we have a long-term trend of slowing job growth. And by the way, the jobs being created are service jobs, which means they are heavily part-time temp contract jobs. Retail, where you get job growth in retail, or in leisure, hospitality, right? Those are almost all part-time jobs. They don't hire full-time people and give them benefits anymore in any of that. It's all part-time work, or virtually. Involuntary part-time work, by the way. You know, the government statistics show involuntary part-time at 5.3 million, another 1.5 million marginally attached workers. In other words, they don't have jobs, and they're barely looking, if not looking at all. Right? It's all service jobs, temp part-time service work. If you look at the job numbers just reported in manufacturing, stagnant. Last year, declined. Most of the year, manufacturing employment. How about construction? Same thing, stagnant, decline. Government job creation, declining, stagnant. So those jobs that really create things, produce and create things, not just services, right, aren't growing at all. It's only service jobs, which you can more easily create part-time temp in nature. Okay, so ominous developments there in terms of the job market, I think, longer term. Well, you know, those businesses that are thinking of investing, they'll think about that. Bank loans. Bank loan. Bank lending. Bank lending slowing rapidly. 2014 to 16, bank lending to businesses, commercial industrial loans, right? 10% a year on the average growth rate. What's the growth rate now? Less than 3. Bank lending is declining. Well, if you got bank lending declining, you got less investment occurring. And that sort of juxtaposes, you know, logically here with this decline in non-residential, non-housing fixed investment to only 3%. Let's go back to the job numbers here. You know, the labor force participation rate is critical. What is that? That's, you know, what percent of the eligible people between 65 and 16 years old who could be in the labor force are actually in the labor force, right? Well, what we've got is a decline in the labor force participation rate in recent decades from about 66-67% to 62.9% last month. All right, that doesn't sound like a lot, right? 63%, let's round it off, and 67%, the 4%. But 4% of 155 million people in the labor force is over 6 million people. 6 million people plus have dropped out of the labor force. Some estimates say that 10 million people have dropped out of the labor force in recent decades, since 2000. 10 million. Well, they don't count them in the unemployment rate. In the 25 to 54 age group, studies show that for every one person looking for a job, 3 have dropped out. 3 aren't looking. 25 to 54 aren't looking. Well, they're discouraged or worse. Dropouts spend 2,000 hours, studies by the Bureau of Labor Statistics show, 2,000 hours watching TV. That's about the time that they would have spent working, 2,000 hours a year, if you work a regular 40-hour work week. 57% of the men who drop out in that age group get a disability check. Well, they're not really disabled, but, you know, you play the disability game in order to get something because unemployment insurance craps out after 6 months. 50% of them are on painkillers. You want your opioid epidemic? That's it. That's it. Discouraged, disenchanted dropouts who can't get work, you know, and that kind of juxtaposes as well with this other statistic I talked about a few months ago or a few weeks ago about how the suicide rate for males, working-age males, is going through the roof, the suicide rate and the death rate for white males going through the roof, you know. All this sort of works together, you see. All this, declining productivity and investment and therefore stagnating jobs and the quality of jobs, bank lending, and labor force participation rate collapse. And what else do we see recently? Well, retail sales last 2 months have gone negative. Negative. March, negative 0.2%. February, negative 0.3%. This is the first time that we've had this situation two consecutive months like this since 2008. Okay, how about autos? You know, I've in past years saying, watch autos, they're peaking. Last year they did peak, and now we have a decline in auto sales 3 months in a row. This is the worst decline in autos since 2008. Autos play a big role in retail sales. Retail sales collapsing, going negative. And they're talking about a big recovery of the economy? Come on. No way. No way. And that's, you know, that's why the Federal Reserve is going slow on raising rates. They see this data, and they're, you know, they say to themselves, I'm sure, whoa, wait a minute, we got to wait and see what happens. Premature. Because if they raise rates again in June, That's going to slow down the housing market even more and slow down the auto market even more. So they're kind of reluctant. They'll probably do it anyway, though. Because if they don't raise rates, they got nothing to play with in the next recession, which is coming, I think, in 2018. Okay, so the economy doesn't look all that healthy. If you look at the figures behind the scenes and don't read the hype that the press is engaging in, that, oh, we got this recovery under Mr. Trump. Okay, let's talk about something else, policies. Two other policy developments here I think are worth looking at before we get to this topic of, is Trump really president? Okay, I want to talk about Trump Care, right? Yesterday, the House of Representatives passed its version of Trump Care. It's no change from its previous version, essentially, right? As the editorial in the Wall Street Journal today said, the bill, quote, the bill is remarkably similar to the one the GOP leaders first introduced. Yeah, that's true. You know, it really irks me about all this reporting on the Trump Care is that there's very little mention of the $592 billion tax cuts for wealthy and businesses and insurers that are part of this Trump Care bill. You see, that's what they're really after. You know, that's why there's been so much resistance to Obamacare among corporations in the right wing. You know, it's the corporations that fund these right-wing talking heads that kept bashing Obamacare here. $592 billion tax cut. See, that hasn't changed in this so-called revision here. We still got this big tax cut. But, you know, you don't hear that in the discussion or read that in the discussion about this revision bill, do you? It's all talk about pre-existing conditions and what's happening with pre-existing conditions or lifetime limits, you know, or some of the other measures that get all the attention, but, you know, they conveniently avoid the fact that this is a huge, huge tax cut for the rich. And the Republicans wanted to get this revision and this tax cut through before they turn their attention to even the bigger tax cut that's coming. You know, they couldn't leave this $592 billion on the table and talk about tax cuts elsewhere. It would have complicated it. So they're going to take a first bite of the tax cut apple here with this Trump Care revision 2.0, which is really 1.0 with tweaks. And then they're going to go after the big tax cuts. All right, the bill passes the House by essentially one vote, 217-213, barely passes. And what's in it? Well, the big tax cuts that I just mentioned, which the heart of which was a tax on families earning more than $250,000 in income a year. They had to pay a 0.9%, 0.9, you know, 0.9% increase in their payroll tax, and then they had to pay a 3.8% tax on their investment income. You know, people in that $250,000 above make most of their money in investments. So, you know, that's why the rich hated this thing, because of the tax. You know, medical equipment companies hated it because there was a device tax. And insurance companies hated it because there was insurance tax. And businesses hated it because they had to provide if they had no employer health insurance coverage, they had to provide it or pay a tax into the system. You know, if they had no health insurance plan, and a lot of these smaller service companies don't. So, you know, there was tax everywhere to pay for the subsidies that were going to you know, folks making $45,000 or below income a year, they were the cost of their insurance premiums were being subsidized. Well, the money was coming from these taxes on the rich in the companies. Okay, so what about this personal mandate, as it is said, that individuals had to buy some sort of tax, some sort of insurance, and if they were making $45,000 a year or less, they would get something back. You know, they would get a subsidy back. Well, that's gone. That's gone, see? So you don't have to buy insurance. You're not required to buy insurance now. But if you decide just before you have a problem maybe to get insurance, a medical problem, well, then you're going to have to pay 30% more for premiums. That's in the bill, 30% more for premiums. In other words, the solution is to raise prices. Prices are going to go up all across the board on this. Pre-existing conditions. Okay. They got a lot of flack when they initially proposed eliminating requirements on insurers to insure anybody under the ACA, even if they had a pre-existing condition, you know, because the insurance companies were just exploiting the hell out of this. You know, if you had a problem with ingrown toenails or something, that was a basis for you to be denied insurance coverage, right? Or if you had some genetic problem, you know, that was chronic, et cetera, or if you ever had cancer before, or if you, you know, had some indication of heart problem, they, you know, they only wanted to insure healthy people because that was profitable, right? Well, under ACA, they had to, they couldn't deny, if you had a pre-existing condition, they couldn't deny giving you insurance. Well, the compromise here in the TrumpCare 2.0 is that, okay, you know, we can't deny you if you have pre-existing, but we can raise prices whatever we want on you. Yeah, you can still get it if you have pre-existing condition, but how much are you going to pay for it, folks? Oh, they say they're going to put money in a high-risk pool for these kind of people. In other words, you're going to be in a second-class insurance group here, and there's going to be a high-risk pool in the government. The states will put some money into it, but it won't be enough. So you're going to pay through the nose. In other words, you raise price. Well, you know, insurance companies like that. this is really George Bush's health savings accounts by another name, because instead of subsidies reimbursements, you get a tax cut, a tax credit, you know, for your cost at the end of the year. If you're making less than $45,000, you get a tax credit. Well, actually, they raised it, you know. You're going to be able to get a tax credit if you make $150,000. Uh-huh. That's interesting, isn't it? Right. And you'll be able to get subsidies of some kind, up to $150,000 instead of $45,000. Well, actually, a tax cut, right, because the subsidies are gone, right? That cut $300 billion out of the ACA. Another $880 billion was eliminated by removing coverages for Medicaid, 74 million people who are poor, disabled, they're elderly. Well, this is the same as the TrumpCare 1.0, you know, eliminate the subsidies, eliminate Medicaid, eliminate Planned Parenthood, covers 2.5 million women. Mm-hmm. Ah, but the cuts that were there in Medicare were kept. So no personal mandate, you know. Pre-existing conditions, okay, but you pay more through the nose. $900 billion tax cut for the wealthy. High-risk pools. Cutting subsidies. Planned Parenthood coverage is gone. The market-based approach, which means higher prices and costs, more profits for insurers. Insurance companies, by the way, are behind the scenes here, really pushing this thing, really lobbying, threatening, like Aetna, threatening to drop out if you don't make these changes, right? There's an interesting also provision here that popped up I've read, and that is a corresponding impact on existing employer-provided health insurance plans. Under this this TrumpCare 2.0, these companies that already provide insurance can adopt the rules of the most liberal state. Liberal in this case meaning weakest provisions for health care, you know, like Mississippi or something like that, right? whatever the rules are for lifetime limits, payments, pre-existing conditions, whatever, right? They can adopt and apply it nationwide. The weakest rules here. So you're going to see less coverage, not less cost, less coverage for existing employer health insurance plans, which, you know, are, you know, tokenly outside of the ACA. ACA is for individuals. No employer mandate. Bare bones plans at higher costs. Okay, so this is what this thing is all about. It's not really much different than the first plan, with a lot of ballyhoo about, you can keep pre-existing conditions. Yeah, but you're going to pay through the nose. But everything else is pretty much the same, you see. Oh, they're going to create this little pool. They tweaked it. They tweaked it in order to get this marketing public relations spin that, oh, you can keep your pre-existing conditions. I mean, pre-existing conditions won't prevent you from having insurance, right? The rest is pretty much the same. So, a lot of ballyhoo about, we're going to take care of these people. No, you're going to pay through the nose, people with pre-existing conditions. And that's all there really is changing this thing. They had to get this thing put to bed somehow and get these big tax cuts out of the way before they went on to the really big tax cut bill that we saw announced here, outlines of which were announced a couple weeks ago in Trump's one-pager or his budget's one-pager. You know, we've seen two things here, Will. Trump announces, we're going to have my budget, and then, you know, comes out bare bones. And, we're going to have tax cuts. Oh, it's just the outlines. But let's turn to that. You know, let's ask ourselves, what's going on with this Trump? Events are appearing with growing frequency, raising the question, who's really running the White House and the government? Is Trump really the president? You know, he sits there on a second floor, spending late evenings into early mornings tweeting to the world. Now, that's weird. But what he's tweeting and the next day fallout is even more weird. Remember the aircraft carrier task force that he tweeted about? You know, North Korea, you know, that he was sending an aircraft carrier task force to North Korea, right, to put pressure on the North Koreans a few weeks ago. We learned that, well, the task force was actually going in the other direction to Australia. It actually wasn't going north, right? Well, did Donald imagine that? Was the U.S. Navy informed or requested by the commander-in-chief, the Donald, to turn around and go north, but then it didn't? Was his command to go north perhaps countermanded by some head of naval operations or maybe someone else in government? Or did he just imagine it all? They never even formed the Navy. They head to Korea. That's all strange, very strange. And then there was, as I just mentioned, his announcement that he's going to put out his big budget here. In just a few days, he tweets that, you know, a couple of weeks ago. He wasn't even anywhere near prepared. So the government bureaucrats had to quickly slap something together in a couple of pages and peddle it to the press. Outline, that's all, you know. And what was the essence of that? It was, we're going to cut $58 billion in social programs and all these other departments. EPA, Environmental Protection, Labor, and all the other departments. We're going to cut $58 billion, and we're going to give $58 billion to the military. Yeah, it was a one-for-one quid pro quo. And that's you know, the most important point of his budget that he announced. Here comes my budget, right? Whoop. All right, so they got a Office of Management and Budget Director here has to throw something together, and he throws it out to the press. One two pager? I don't know. And then he does it again with the tax cuts here a week or so ago, right? Big tax cuts coming. Big tax cuts. It's as if because Trump Care 1.0 failed, he had to come up with something. So he throws out the budget thing, then throws out the big tax cut thing. Yeah. Big tax cut, $2.2 trillion in his tax cut outline, $2.2 trillion, reducing the top corporate tax rate from, you know, the 35% to 15%. Whoa. Yeah. Well, is he going to close the loopholes? No. You know, that proposal includes allowing... rolling back even the weak rules that the Obama administration had imposed on multinational corporations, investing abroad, changing their headquarters, called the tax inversions, right, and locating on paper their company in Ireland or Belgium or something like that, Luxembourg, you know, to get out from under the taxes. Because tax rates over there are far less, you see. You know, all this talk about the U.S. Corporations, multinational corporations, pay a U.S. tax and then they pay another tax over, you know, outside the U.S. and state taxes and so forth. And we have the highest tax rate, corporate tax rate in the world. That's BS. Not true. What matters is the effective tax rate, not what they actually pay. You know what multinational corporations actually pay? Studies have been shown. Not 35%. 12.2% is what their effective rate is. And that's why they hold trillions of dollars offshore. Because even though we had a foreign profits tax is not enforced. Tech companies, banks, pharma companies especially hoard their cash offshore. Apple, $250 billion in cash, 90% of which is held offshore. And he wants to cut their tax rate, the nominal tax rate, from 35% to 15%. Of course, that means that the effective tax rate will go from 12.2 to maybe 5. And he's going to take away deductions and exemptions from average taxpayers, right? The proposal is really, one of the other features of the proposal is to eliminate state income tax deductions and sales tax deductions. Oh, that's really going after New York and California, you know, where the state taxes are high, right? Where he doesn't get the votes anyway, so he doesn't care. So, in other words, average Mrs. taxpayer is going to pay for the big corporate tax cut, 15% nominal. Another provision is they're inviting companies that have stashed more than $2 trillion offshore, big multinationals, to bring it back, and you only have to pay, I think he's under his plan, 8%? Instead of 35%? You know, nominal 8%, and then of course they work all their loophole magic and probably not pay anything. This happened before in 2005. You see, under George Bush, companies were hoarding cash offshore, and they passed a law that said, "Oh, if you bring it back, repatriation tax bill. If you bring it back, you only have to pay 5.25%. Oh, but you got to invest it here in the U.S." Well, they brought the money back. And they invested in the U.S., but it wasn't in jobs. They invested in mergers and acquisitions. That's what happened. Well, they're just repeating the same thing, you see. It's even more generous now. Well, these are some of the elements of the quote outline of the Trump tax plan. You know, he promised $6 trillion in tax cuts during the election. You know, and this one-page version here is already over $2 trillion in tax cuts for corporations, especially multinationals, and rich investors, and the top 1%. This is who the tax cuts are going to, and the rest of us, middle class, are going to pay for it. Right? Anyway, you know, that was weird. He throws this thing out in the middle of a tweet, in the middle of the night, just like his budget, you know, just like his aircraft carrier. He throws it out here, and then the bureaucrats have to scramble the next day to make sense of it, put some spin on it that makes it credible. Right? He tweets, and the bureaucracy jumps. But who's communicating to what? Is he just lobbing these electronic policy missiles out of the second floor of the White House, hoping some bureaucrat will catch them before the morning? Maybe Trump is just, sitting up there on the second floor, doing his tweet thing, while others are running the government. Beginning to look like that. Well, what others? Well, certainly Pence is playing. Vice President Pence is somewhere in this mix, working with some shadow committee, maybe, of key cabinet officers and intelligence spooks at the NSA, CIA, and FBI. You know, these are the people running the government. Not this guy. This guy is for public consumption. You know? Well, the generals, the spooks, and the Goldman Sachs financial pirates run the show. You know, all these appointees to the Treasury and the Office of Management and Budget and Council of Economic Advisors and so forth, they're all Goldman Sachs ex-players. Goldman Sachs, government by Goldman Sachs, at least on the economic side. And, of course, generals. Behind the scenes, the spooks. National Security Agency, CIA, FBI, and all the others, right? They're running the show, and this guy's sitting up there late night in the morning, you know, tweeting his tweets, and when the sun rises, you know, they trot him down to sign another executive order, you know, do a little interview with this or that media reporter, you know, and then go give his friends four-hour tours, I guess, right? You know, it's really hard to believe that the state bureaucracy knew of some of his recent tweets welcoming Philippines President Duterte to the White House. All of a sudden, you know, you come to the White House, Duterte. Okay, so you had 7,000 people killed on orders here, you know, as you go after what you say are the drug dealers in the Philippines. Yeah. Civil rights advocate here, Duterte, right? Oh, come on to the White House. You're a good guy. Come on, right? Well, he praises Egyptian President al-Sisi, right? And Erdogan and the great Democrat there in Turkey, right? He loves these kind of people. And then he tweets also that he's willing to meet with North Korea's president, for whom he, Trump, has great respect, right? He says that publicly. He has great respect for this guy. Can you imagine the political constipation that comment caused with the spooks and generals in charge of the State Defense and National Security Departments? Yeah. All right. You know, last November 30th, I wrote a piece, also on my blog, jackrasmus.com, predicting that Trump, the right-wing populist during the election, would be successfully tamed by the political elites of this country that really run the show. I laid out some ideas of how that might be accomplished, but I didn't think it would happen so fast, so easily. You know, he's done a total about-face on virtually all his right-wing populist proposals during the election. He's backtracked so fast, it's a wonder he hasn't tripped over himself. Well, yeah, he has tripped over himself. What explains this 180-degree turnout? Was it all election hype? Did he just tell people what he thought they wanted to hear? And then do whatever the money bags running the show really want from him? The big tax cuts, one. The across-the-board deregulation, two. End the taxes on Obamacare, three. And give us some infrastructure spending deals that resurrect wheeling-dealing commercial property investments with big tax loopholes. And then, of course, just tweak and rearrange the free trade treaties. Put a little squeeze on your capitalist competitors over there in Europe and Japan or whatever and get a better deal. That's all that's about. What we get from him in his first 100 days is government by executive orders. What's he done? He's repealed environmental protections. He's gutted immigrants' rights. He's going after sanctuary cities. He's opening up national monuments and parks to mining and cattle exploitation. He's subsidizing killer coal companies, attacking consumer protection. Smoke and mirror changes to the H-1B skilled worker visa import program, which hasn't changed. You know, if you'd really concerned about creating jobs in the U.S., you know, you wouldn't allow 500,000 jobs to go to skilled foreigners imported into the country. You know, not these immigrants, poor immigrants from the rest of the world, but, you know, they come from mostly from India and Asia. He's gutting K-12 education, shifting funds to private schools from public, opening up offshore drilling, and giving special breaks to religious organizations. Right? These are what his executive orders are all about, right? Nothing really to do with economics. He does a reversal on China, declaring it during the election as a currency manipulator. Now he's offering major concessions at his Mar-a-Lago meeting in exchange for help with North Korea. I wonder if China's offshore islands occupation is part of the deal. He moves from NATO is a waste of money and unnecessary. Now NATO is the great bulwark against Russia. From Putin, the great leader, to Putin responsible for Syria using poison gas, of which there's still no proof, by the way. You know, is it true? Or is it all in that great American tradition of Yellow Cakes, 2003, Iraq, you know, creating nuclear bombs, Saddam, right? Babies are being thrown from the incubators, 1990, the first invasion, you know, Kuwait. Tonkin Gulf, 1964, was the excuse for going in to Vietnam. Oh, we got to go invade Panama City. Well, because of drugs, 1990. The Soviets are in Grenada in the 1980s. And remember the Maine, Spanish-American War. You know, this is all great American tradition here. You create these false crises as an excuse for going in. I wonder what the excuse is going to be in North Korea. He backs off from saying Mexico's going to pay for the war to the latest of that, Homeland Security Secretary. No, there's not going to be a wall everywhere, right? From dumping NAFTA to, quote, I'm not going to terminate NAFTA, right? About-faced on NAFTA, about-faced on NATO. He holds these press conferences with companies like Carrier Corporation, you know, big PR deal indicating they're not going to export some jobs to Mexico for now, as they continue to export other jobs to Mexico now. Carrier. And we get this list of these companies announcing, oh, they're going to hire jobs in the U.S., you know, not saying when and how many, but it's good PR. He cancels the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Deal, which is already killed in Congress, so it was easy. Right? To now he's declaring a reopening of the TTIP Free Trade Deal with Europe. And he strikes a deal with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Right? Now it's being leaked out that Abe and Japan is going to pick up the lead on the TPP, and the U.S. will join later. And then there's Mexico's recent offer to the U.S. We'll see what the response to that is. Mexico offers that says, let's reform NAFTA by simply adopting the terms and conditions of the TPP that you and I, U.S. and Mexico, have already agreed upon, right? That will be the cover. We'll say we're changing NAFTA, but we're really turning NAFTA into TPP. Watch these backdoor free trade resurrections. They're coming. And then, of course, he does an organization about face, demotes right-wing ideologue Steve Bannon from the National Security Council, and he fires Flynn, General Flynn, of course. You know, what I find interesting, too, is all this previous media attack on him, all his Russia connection, his tax returns, nepotism in the White House, his companies benefiting, violating the emoluments clause of the Constitution, and calls for his impeachment, all of a sudden, they're gone. Have you noticed that? They're moved off the front page. They're not there anymore. And we don't hear any more damaging leaks coming from the intelligence spooks either, do we? Instead, what we read about is, he's coming around, he's beginning to look presidential. You think all that's coincidental to his 180-degree flip on all these other positions from NATO and Russia and free trade and China? I don't think it's coincidental. You know, Donald gets to sit on the second floor of the White House and do his late-night tweet thing. And the bureaucrats scurry around the next day trying to clean it up. And as I said, he's then brought downstairs to the Oval Office for executive order signings. We saw a long list of those, right? And occasionally interviews with a reporter, and then trots back upstairs. Makes his late-night calls to his moneybag friends, like the billionaire Mercers and others that financed him. And ask, how am I doing, guys? Oh, you're doing good, Donald. Just keep it up. While the rest of the representatives of the economic and political elite in this country run the show. I wonder if this is a Trump presidency or just a government by generals Goldman Sachs and Pence with Trump's son-in-law Kushner running between as intermediary. It's a government of second-floor tweets and first-floor executive order signing events. But, you know, the quality of the American presidency has been in decline for decades now. Now, you go back, we started with this crook called Nixon, right? And then we had this inept peanut farmer called Jimmy Carter, who just blew a great opportunity to move America into a progressive direction, because the Republicans coming out of Nixon, Watergate, collapse of Vietnam, and the worst recession and runaway inflation since World War II in the 1970s, Carter comes in. Carter could have done a lot, but he didn't. He attempted to placate business, and paved the way, by the way, for Ronald Reagan. The last 2 years of Carter's administration, 78 to 80, people don't realize, but, he proposed the Ronald Reagan light reforms here and legitimized the big tax cuts under Reagan, legitimized a lot of the other policies. Yeah, he moved from a middle road Democrat to a Republican light. And then, of course, Reagan comes in, camera-friendly movie actor Ronald Reagan, big myth about Reagan, gives us the worst deficits, begins the whole deficit problem in the United States, trade deficits, budget deficits, proposing $790 billion tax cut, mostly for businesses, was so bad that they had to take some of it back in 1986. But they also gave bigger tax cuts to businesses in 86 as well. Right? So we go from Nixon to inept Carter to you know, this great speaker, friendly face, Ronald Reagan, to the morally sleazy opportunist, Bill Clinton, who in his second term also stumbled over himself trying to placate business interests, giving them tax cuts. 1997-98 tax cuts paved the way for George Bush's massive tax cuts. Clinton opened the door that Bush drove his truck through as far as tax cuts are concerned for the rich and wealthy and so forth. You know, it's also under Clinton that we started getting this problem with health insurance cost increases. Well, that's a direct consequence of his so-called Health Maintenance Organization bill. Yeah. Also, his exempting of health insurance companies from antitrust so that they could gobble each other up. To gobble each other up, they went to Wall Street. Wall Street gave them loans to buy each other up, and then Wall Street demanded, you know, well, 22% returns. Oh, so that's where we get limits on lifetime coverage and pre-existing conditions exemptions and all the rest, and double-digit health insurance increases to fund, to pay back Wall Street, to fund all the mergers and acquisitions and concentration that went on. Today we only have 5 health insurance companies control 80% of the market or more. Yeah, well, when you get concentration like that, you get price increases. And the biggest spenders on lobbying are the health insurance companies and the health insurance industry. Okay, and then we get know-nothing George Bush, who comes in and gives $3.7 trillion tax cuts to the wealthy, and proposes HSAs, health savings accounts, which now we're getting under Trump. And we get the super cautious, phony progressive called Obama. And now we got the fake right populist blowhard Tweety Bird called Donald Trump. Yeah. Some really qualified people up there in the presidency. But, you know, it doesn't matter how qualified they are, because increasingly I believe that they're just front men. These guys are front men for the real forces and the real economic and political elites who run the show. And it's more obvious than ever now with Donald Trump. Okay, Donald. Go do your tweets and, you know, come downstairs at 9 o'clock and we'll do an interview or we'll do a signing and so forth. And, you know, you can run down to your multi-million-dollar estate there, Mar-a-Lago, you know, and bring in all the foreign presidents and walk them around, show them how rich you are, right? Go play a few rounds of golf on your golf course, and we'll run the cameras as you do, and we'll pump that to the press and to the media and to the public, right? This is what we got. This is what we've got. Boy, we're going to need a lot of luck to get through the next 3.5 years, folks. Is Donald really the president? I don't think so. Okay. That's it for today. Alternative Visions. This is Jack Rasmus. Next week, maybe we'll do a follow-up, I think, on the French elections coming up on Sunday. We'll see what happens. You know, they're really predicting that this guy Macron's going to get all the votes and keep the Le Pen, you know, Trump French style out. I don't know. I'm not convinced. They may be surprised. All right, Alternative Visions, Jack Rasmus.